Well, we have Judges chapter 1 this morning for our Sunday school lesson. We're getting into a period of study now that I think mirrors a lot of how things go spiritually in every generation. The generation of Joshua was, I think, one of the exceptions. And of course, it should be the rule when you see that God makes everything possible for those who will serve him. But the book of Judges, you have seven spiritual declines and failures. And of course, there's reasons for it. Things just don't fall off on their own when it comes to spiritual decline. And so the point is, I think we'll see in this chapter how it all began and how that a slippery path was chosen on the part of the nation, and that is they did not strive to be perfect with God. And I'm not talking about sinless perfection, but I'm talking about being complete in obedience, not neglecting things that we know should be done, and not failing to carry out, or let's say failing to carry out the orders of God like they should be carried out. Well, those are all slippery slopes that are going to create greater problems later on in life. Israel's faithfulness to God had served them well in the days that we studied in the book of Joshua. And as far as government was concerned, you find that their faithfulness to God, they never had a problem there. And it didn't matter whatever it was. Social, when it came to dealing with their enemies, all of that was well in hand. But when they turned away from God, it seemed like everything began to unravel. Their homes, their society, their nation, everything just seemingly had a logjam to it. And it's because that God was not the one who was the Lord of their life. And even came to the place where they were destitute and eating their own children and a whole lot of other horrible things that can happen when people are in a state where God is not helping them. So to strive to be perfect in our response to God is really the theme of our thoughts this morning. And you can see how that it's easy to get away from that. And it seems like at the moment, it just fits right with what's going on to do that. So we have now, Joshua is no longer with them. They're at a point now where they don't have one leader like that. They had Moses and they had Joshua. But now they're going to have to, as a nation and as individuals, each of them be responsible to call upon God and not necessarily just lean on somebody else all the time. There is a point in our life where we need leadership, and there's a point in our life where we have to take responsibility ourselves. And we know that it's when people are taking responsibilities themselves that things begin to happen in a good way. Christ told his disciples in the book of John chapter 16 and verse 7, he said, "It is expedient for you that I go away." And while he was here on earth, he had been with them every day. All of their squabbles, he would give them an answer for it, you might say. When it came to doing anything, he told them what to do. But he said, "It's necessary that I go away." And that the work of God would then broaden out, and that the people themselves would take over as far as picking up the load and moving on with it. And so leadership is necessary, but we must not come to the point where we defer everything to leadership ourselves. We have to take up our cross, and we have to follow the Lord, and we have to become productive in our own life and in our own service. So after the death of Joshua, now they were in control of the land, But I want to go back to the 23rd chapter, and there in verse 4 and 5 of Joshua, Joshua 23, 4 and 5, he said, "Behold, I have divided unto you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes from Jordan with all the nations that I have cut off, even unto the great sea westward. And the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them out, from out of your sight, and ye shall possess their land as the Lord your God hath promised unto you." So the land had been conquered. There was really no question that Israel was in control overall. They had already described the boundaries of the tribes, but all of the inhabitants of the land were not driven out yet. And so that's where we come into Judges. They are now needing to undertake to drive out the inhabitants of the land. Now, there are those that I saw a little show on Madeline Murray O'Hara. I don't know whether some of you heard of her or not. She was the famed atheist that rose up and started the ball rolling to get Bible reading and prayer out of school and so on like that. But she claimed to have read the Bible through, and she was appalled at all of the violence that was in the Bible. And so therefore she could not accept what the Bible had to say. Now, lest we happen to have any of those feelings about us, I know one of the former presidents made a comment one time that the military of our country, it has not done a lot of the things like you see done in the Old Testament, and priding himself as if he was above what the Bible gives us a record of. What we are not really considering, if we're thinking those thoughts, is the wickedness of the nations that God said drive out. There came a point in the day of Noah that God had to destroy the human race with the except of 8 people. That's how wicked it was. And so the land of Canaan now has come to the point, like God told Abraham early on, that when he showed him the promised land and told him about how that his seed would go down into a nation, which was Egypt, and they would be afflicted there over 400 years, and then they would come out. He explained it to Abraham that, yes, I've given you this land, but he said the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet to its fullest. So God was long-suffering with these people, but they came to a point where there was nothing else that could be done except to eliminate them. And you say, oh, that's so cruel. But think about something. If you have a group of people and all of their doing is bringing other people into the world to then live and die and go to hell, they're simply a group of people that are just making hell full. And God doesn't like to see that. He does not like to see that. Plus, he created man for his honor and his glory. And so when people get so far away from him, then there comes a point of judgment. So this is divine judgment in driving these nations out because they have crossed the line with him. And that's just like that there comes a point when God's going to cast every unbeliever into the lake of fire, as you read in Revelation chapter 20. So we have to get our understanding from the Bible and not draw upon the conclusions that people have about it. But after Joshua's death, now the tribes have the task of driving out the inhabitants. So they do the right thing. In verse 1, they ask God, who shall undertake to do this first? And of course, God said, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have delivered the land into his hand. So this is not only according to God's promise, but God is well aware of the fact that Judah is going to take action that he can bless and honor. Now, the tribe of Judah is the tribe from which Christ inherits the throne of David. The tribe of Judah also had a lot of significance in the Old Testament, because it was, if you recall, that when the nation divided into Israel, the northern kingdom Israel, the southern kingdom Judah. And that's because they were the ones that pretty well maintained their devotion to God, where the other ten tribes did not. But Judah as a man, as a person, was also one that there is a significant typology about him. And if you recall, maybe you don't, but I'll just point it out, in the 37th chapter of Genesis, when the brothers of Joseph were going to kill him, Judah interceded, said, "Let's don't kill him." So he was an intercessor. And he said, of course, it wasn't a good thing, but he said, "Let's just sell him as a slave." But anyway, he interceded for his life. In the 44th chapter of Genesis, when the sons had come down unto Joseph in Egypt seeking food and did not know it was Joseph, and Joseph had put them through some tests to provoke their thinking about their need to get things straight with God. And one of the things that turned out was that Benjamin was brought down into Egypt, and then there was a cup of Joseph put into Benjamin's sack, and then this was all by plan of Joseph, and then Benjamin was arrested, and Benjamin was then going to be kept in Egypt by Joseph. But Judah interceded and said, "No, if we do that, it'll kill my father. He'll die of grief if we do not bring Benjamin back." And he said, "Take me. Let me be a substitute for Benjamin." So you can see again an intercessor. So when you carry that forward in connection with Christ, Judah is a type of Christ in that sense, because Judah engaged the powers of darkness, and of course he did it first, and by him, let me get this straight. Judah was the one to step forward, and Christ, of course, like Judah, engaged the powers of darkness first, so where he can be an inspiration to the rest of us in all of our conflicts. So Judah kind of stands out as a type of Christ in being in the forefront. And in the 49th chapter of Genesis, you'll also find where Jacob pronounced a blessing upon Judah as being the one that would be the leader of the nation. So if you're going to be in that place of honor and that place of leadership, you have to be the one to step up and take the work first. And that's what you find here. Duty goes right along with any honor that a person might have. And so the burden of honor and work, they always go together. Well, Judah then invites Simeon. And if you go back and see how that their boundaries were settled in the 19th chapter of Joshua, Judah had a large territory. If you have a Bible map in your Bible, they had a large territory, and it was too large for them. So Simeon was given territory within the territory of Judah. So Judah was all around Simeon, but Simeon was a small tribe. So Judah asked Simeon, the men of the tribe of Simeon, if they would go with them and join forces to drive out the Canaanites. And of course, they were willing to do that. Now, there are some things there that we can gather from. First of all, people of like faith can work together. And there are limitations that you have to be careful about. But when it comes to working together, we know that the Bible speaks in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 of different administrations, but the same Lord. So hopefully there are a lot of New Testament churches yet in our world that are still carrying on the work of God. And we have to be careful, however, that we do not let our relations with others be to where that we're influenced by any discrepancies they might have. And this is one of the things that you get into working with other churches, is that sometimes you'll find some discrepancies that they have accepted. And so then it raises a question, well, what about this? Is this right or is this wrong? So I think that a church has to guard itself and not subject itself to situations that would raise confusion just for the sake of wanting to have inter-church fellowship and go outside the bounds of church fellowship. And this is one of the things that I have been quite concerned about. And so therefore, maybe my approach has not been correct, but I have felt that we need to not expose ourselves to the activities of others that are not according to the Bible. And I'm sure there's others out there that are straight and doing the Lord's work, but you have to be careful. Because if you start just wanting to fellowship with other churches just for the sake of fellowshipping with other churches, then the first thing can happen is you can start picking up on things. And these things can be a problem. But I'm grateful that there are other churches out there doing the work of God. And if you have them on the right spiritual level, you can work with them. And that is a good thing. That's how our church was started, as a mission. Another church started us. And there were other churches that we, in my generation, that I knew about that were sound, that we could work with. Now I don't know so much. So I'm not saying that they're not out there. I'm just saying I don't know them. And so therefore, let's just stay with Christ as our head and let the Lord lead from there. The other thing about what you see in there helping one another, the stronger was working with the weaker. There was nobody despising one another, but everybody helping one another. And I think that whenever we help one another in love, well, we can expect God to help us. So moving on from that, you find in verse 5 that Adonai Bezek was captured. Adonai Bezek apparently was no small pigeon, but he was a great king because he had subdued 70 other kings. So this was a great accomplishment to overcome such a king as this. And this is what God had promised them, that there would be no one that would be able to stand before them as they would go forth. And so now, the things that the previous generation, if you recall, the previous generation was concerned about the greatness of the powers in Canaan and said that we're like grasshoppers in their sight. Well, now you see the grasshoppers are conquering the giants. And it's because that they are thinking with God. They know that God is there with them. And therefore, God is giving them this victory. Not only that, but you see that Adonai Bezek in verse 7, after that, when Joshua, or not Joshua, but when the tribe of Judah had conquered him, you notice they cut off his thumbs and his great toes in verse 6. Well, that's something unique, but you know what that would do. That would render a person not able to be a warrior anymore. They would not be able to physically be able to wage war. So that took away their power. It was symbolic of subduing these kings. So when they cut his thumbs off and his toes, he said, well, I did that to 70 other kings. And so he said, God hath requited me. Well, as you sow, so shall you reap. But I want to make a point that God makes about judgment. God tells us that we will be judged out of our own mouth. God tells us that every knee will bow, every tongue will confess. And so you have a man confessing something that he realizes is so self-evident to him. I did this, now the judgment has come upon me. And this is what the judgment is going to be when we stand before God. It'll be such a realization that, yes, I'm deserving of this. This is something that I made the choice in, and so therefore they will even be able to confess, we'll be able to confess with our own mouth that the judgment is so correct. So I think it's good to keep in mind that judgment is going to be retribution, and it can be for faithfulness or it can be for shame. And so it is going to be so appropriate that we will be able to even with our own mouth say that it's so right when God does bring judgment upon us. Adonai Bezek referred to God in verse 7 as God hath requited me. Now that didn't mean he was a child of God. If you go back and think of the kings that Abraham dealt with, Abimelech, and others that you'll find, that people would make reference to God. Balaam made reference to God. But that doesn't mean that just because someone refers to God, they're a child of God. We know there's a whole lot of people today that make reference to God, but that doesn't mean that they're a child of God. They have knowledge, but they have never truly turned in faith unto him. Now we get into some other comments about the tribe of Judah. Judah was the first to go forth. Judah was the one that God gave victories unto. But Judah also had some elements within them that is worthy of mention. And one of them is the household of Caleb. Caleb, if you recall, was one of the spies that did not agree with the other 10 spies. It says, we cannot conquer Canaan. He said, yes, we can. And he and Joshua took the Lord's side and said, God's told us we can do it, so we can do it. And then God, when he brought his judgment upon the rest of the nation, he said, Joshua and Caleb are the only two of those 12 spies that will not be judged. And they will not die, but they will be able to go into the land of Canaan because of their faithfulness. So the whole generation died off except for Joshua and Caleb. They were faithful unto God. One of the accounts of Caleb's faith is again mentioned here. This was something that was done back in the book of Joshua in chapter 15 in our previous study of this, but in verse 11 down through verse 15 of this chapter, there's the account where when Caleb was conquering, he made an offer that he that smiteth in verse 12, he that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer and taketh it, to him will I give Aksa my daughter to wife. Well, that sounds very strange to us. But what it was about was Caleb knew that anybody that could take those people, anybody that could defeat those people, would have to be a man of faith. He would have to be one that God was honoring. So he wanted a son-in-law that would be a man of faith. He also knew that anyone who would put his neck out there to do this for his daughter would have to want to love his daughter to do it. Because if he didn't care about his daughter, why would you put your neck out there? So there's two things, a person of faith and a person who would love his wife. And Caleb said, that's the guy I want for my son-in-law. I heard a preacher say one time, he said, the devil owed me a debt and he paid me off in son-in-laws. But anyway, here was a man that wanted a good son-in-law. So he made that proposition. Well, I'm sure that made an impression on a lot of people. You know, that was probably something people would talk about. It was an example, it was a salt, and it was a light. Also, you will find that in verse 20, that when Caleb came into his area of conquering, he asked for this certain territory where there were giants. And he expelled the three sons of Anak in verse 20. These were giants. So he himself did not want to just go to the easy things. He wanted to accept what would take faith to overcome. And he exercised that faith. And I'm sure that the other Israelites probably looked at that and said, wow, you know, Caleb, his faith, look what his faith accomplished. So here are a lot of things about the tribe of Judah that are an inspiration to the rest of the nation, to where that they can look and see how that this in real life works, and how that God will be with us and he will function with us. Now we get into the sad part of the story, and that is that Judah did run well, but they began to fall down. In verse 17, it says, Judah went with Simeon and his brother. They slew the Canaanites that inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. The name of the city was called Hormah. Also, Judah took Gaza. Now, that's the same Gaza that is on the news now. With the coast thereof, and Ashkelon with the coast thereof, and Ekron with the coast thereof. So Gaza, as it is today, belongs to Israel. It was one of the areas that God gave to Israel. And the Lord was with Judah. He drave out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. All right, now let's look at that a little bit. It says they could not drive out the inhabitants because they had chariots of iron. I want to go back to Joshua chapter 17, and there in verse 18. Joshua 17, 18. But the mountain shall be thine, for it is wood. Thou shalt cut it down, and the outgoings of it shall be thine. For thou shalt drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots, and though they be strong. By faith, they could do that. But without that faith, to believe God's promise, they couldn't do it. So here is some things to think about our faith. Sometimes we can draw the perimeters of our faith based on what we see. And, okay, yeah, I can see I can do this. No, I don't think I can do this. So we will draw our own box and say, this is my faith. And it may not be at all in the area that God says it should be. That's what they did. The chariots of iron. Yeah, boy. You know, and so they begin to limit their faith, and when they limited their faith, they couldn't drive them out. They just didn't. If you don't believe it can happen, it won't happen. If you don't believe God can help you do it, he's not going to help you do it. And that's what happened. They just fell short here because they were looking at things that are seen, and God says we can't walk by sight. We've got to walk by faith. But we can do that. That's easy to do. Just look at what's going on and say, well, you know, I don't think I can. And so we limit our faith at that point. Well, sad to say, that became something contagious in the rest of the tribes. And so in verse 21, the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites. that inhabited Jerusalem. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. The house of Joseph, they also went up against Bethlehem. The Lord was with them. The house of Joseph sent to descry Bethel. Now here's another little thing that you can see how it can happen. They went up, the Lord was with them, but they approached this on a different level than what God said they were to do it, and that is that they find a inhabitant of the city, and they say, you show us the best way to get into this city, and we'll spare you. Well, that sounds like a reasonable thing, but that's not what God said they were to do. God didn't tell them that, you know, you start sparing people if they'll do you a favor. If they'll do you a favor, you spare them. Well, this man, when they spared him, he went and joined the Hittites, and the Hittites were enemies of Israel, so all they did was strengthen their enemies. But it looked like a good bargain, you know. Okay, an easy way. Here's an easy way for us to get into this city, is if we just have somebody there show us the easiest way to get in. That's not the same as the bargain that was made with Rahab. Rahab the harlot herself came forward to the spies confessing her faith in God and wanting to be on God's side. This man did not do that at all. He did not come confessing his faith in God. He did not want to become a part of Israel. He rather went to the enemy. So you cannot say this is the same as Rahab. This was a deviation from God's plan. So here's another deviation. Judah deviated. They looked at the chariots and said, well, we can't do it. These developed their own plans and said, well, we'll do this. But all they did was, again, give the enemy a little more strength rather than to carry out God's plan. So we're seeing now that one failure to carry out God's plan becomes something in the minds of other people to do something similar. Well, you know, okay, I see how they did this, so apparently it must be okay for me also. When we are not overcoming by faith, it becomes sort of a justification in the minds of other people. So often I've heard, well, there, look what they did. What I'm doing is no different than what they're doing. That is totally wrong to take that approach, but that's what happens. Especially sometimes young people will, you know, get into that. Well, so-and-so. And so, I'm not doing as bad as they are, so it must be okay. Well, we cannot go down that path. That's the path of getting 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way down and finally coming to an end where we're totally out of bounds with God. But it does become a justification in the minds of others that if they did it, I can do it. And so it just snowballs at that point. So shortcomings and the lack of victory seem to be looked upon as a justification for willful neglect on the part of others. But they're not the same at all. Willful neglect is not the same as if a person out of weakness fails to do something. But they seemingly become a justification. And we have to beware of justifying ourselves based on what others do or don't do. The only way we can be just is if we follow Christ. Otherwise, we're not on the right path at all. But it seems like that's the path that the human nature will take. Well, they're doing it, and they did it, and so therefore, I'm okay in what I'm doing. So tribe after tribe, in verse 27, neither did Manasseh. Okay, and you move on to verse 29, neither did. Verse 30, neither did. Verse 31, neither did. Verse 33, neither did. So what do you have? Okay, they did it, so it's all right for me to do it. They didn't do it, so it's all right for me not to do it. That's one of the biggest blights that can get to work in a congregation of God, and in the thinking of people. Well, they're getting by with it, so why should I try? And it's one of those things that once it gets going, it's really hard to put a stop to it. Another thing to point out is that when Israel was not really going ahead all the way and doing like God said, they ran across, like you see in verse 27, the Canaanites would dwell in the land. Well, Israel is not in the mode of victory by being faithful to God. God is not giving them a total victory because of that. And the Canaanites now are resisting. Well, you notice down in verse 34 even, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down to the valley. Here is a situation where that things are not really with the Lord like they should be. So the strength of the Lord is not there like it needs to be. And then the enemy is resisting. So a person says, well, we can't do it. We can't do it. And I think we must always recognize that the enemy is never going to say, what is it that God wants you to do? I will go along with you in doing that. That's never going to be the case. The enemy or the opposition to God's work is always going to be against it. So don't be surprised when you run across something that you know God would have you to do, but it seems like everything else is opposed to you doing it. Don't be surprised at that. That's the way it's always been. So when you think about these failures on the part of each and every tribe and how that like down in verse 34, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down to the valley. What's happening now? The will of the enemy is now prevailing over the will of God's people. And that's because that God's people are not moving by faith. And the enemy seems to have a strength now. But where did they get that strength? They got that strength from the things that the Israelites were failing to do. And since the Israelites were failing to do, they were not getting the strength to overcome. So the strength of the enemy is greater. But who's responsible? Israel is. Israel's responsible. It's not that the enemy is responsible for having this great strength that Israel cannot overcome. Israel has handed that to them. They have given that to them by not being willing to go all the way like God says they should go. And of course, when you get to the point where you're not going all the way like God says you should go, you don't have God helping you at that point, and then it seems like you cannot go. Cannot go. So that's where they're at. But Israel's, in a sense, gave the enemy that power to be able to stand up and say, no, you're not going to take our ground. Israel gave them that power by their failure to really stand up and say, we're going to do what God said. So that's something I hope maybe you can kind of connect with that. Because these things can build up in our life, and they can produce a leanness in our soul about spiritual things. And the first thing you know, that the will of man, the things of the world, and the way that the world wants us to go seemingly has the dominance in our mind. And that's what's happened now. The world is dominating the thinking of the Israelites. So I just want to read these comments in closing this morning, that there are many things that it is not a matter of church enforcement, but individual choice. When Israel chose to live below the standards that God set forth, they began to reap the harvest. We need to be very conscious of how we are inclined to honor God's plan and purpose, or do what we judge to be best due to our circumstances. When Israel lost interest to take pains to complete their conquest God's way, it evolved into a setting aside their confidence in the power and promises of God. And when they made circumstances their governing factor, they discouraged themselves spiritually. So nothing will substantiate for wholly seeking unto following God God's way. So by permission, Israel became enslaved to their inabilities. They're not able. But they became enslaved to their own inabilities because they permitted themselves not to carry out God's plan. And it seems to be a little, say, what's going on here? Yes, but we have to be aware of not striving for perfection, because if we don't strive to do what God says, we're not going to gain what God says we can have. And then when we don't gain what God says we can have, we don't think we can gain it. And so we're stuck. But we can bring that up on ourselves. But that's why we have to strive for perfection and not begin to let things slide into a direction they should not go. Well, I hope that's something you can reason with and it'll be helpful to you.